Revelation 14, if you will. Revelation 14. This speaks here about the 144,000. And in verse 5, it says something I think is very significant. It says this. They're in a resurrected state here, and it says, "And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God." And it talks about a people who are without guile. And perhaps you've heard of Frank Abagnale. He explains this. If you are to mail a letter, and you want to do this to a friend, and you don't have a stamp, he said there's a way to do this. You just switch the addresses. So you put the address of the person you want to send it to in the return address section, and you put your address as though the letter's going to you, and then the post office will then send it to your friend and tell them they didn't have enough postage on the letter. Anyway, Frank Abagnale is the hero of the latest Spielberg movie that is out, Catch Me If You Can. It's about a boy who runs away from home when his parents divorce, and he finds himself in New York with virtually very little to live on, and he begins to think of what he can do, and the first thing he does is he forges his driver's license. He was 16 years old, and so he changed it, scratched off the number, and changed it to 26 so that he could sort of operate more as an adult. And then he had $100. And so he took the $100 to a bank and deposited it and started a checking account in New York. And it was an interesting story. He got the checks, temporary checks, and he said, what do I do about deposits? And they said, well, we won't have deposit slips until you get your permanent checking. And he said, oh, well, what do I do? And she said, well, we have a whole stack of them, and they're just like your deposit slips, but they don't have your checking account number on them, so you just fill it out and everything will be okay. So Frank went over and took the entire stack home and set them down on his table. And then he went out and bought some ink, just like the bank has, and he took those deposit slips and he very carefully wrote in his bank account number, and then he took them back and set the stack on the counter again. And it wasn't long before he had $40,000, because everybody that used those to make a deposit, it was automatically deposited to his account. It's an amazing thing. So at $40,000, he decided to close it up and he left. But he began to forge checks and began to do this, and over a five-year period, he had forged over $2.5 million worth of checks. He also forged a pilot's identification tag, and with this, he was able to ride free on airplanes. He flew over the entire world, all around the world, and sometimes he'd end up in an area with the pilots there, and they'd have to stay overnight, and of course, he'd stay with them in the hotel, and the hotel would then bill the airlines for his room. Later, he actually forged a degree from Harvard and forged a doctor's certificate, and he then pawned himself off as a doctor, and he was an administrator for over a year as a doctor. Again, we're talking about a young boy, about 18 years old. Then he decided to pose as a lawyer, and he actually took the bar exam and passed this thing. He became a lawyer without ever going to school, and he was served as the assistant attorney general in the state in which he had done this. He was chased all over the world, finally caught in France. And when he was caught, there were 26 countries that served extradition papers on this fellow. 26 countries that were after him. And finally, he was brought to the United States here and extradited to the U.S., where he was sentenced to serve 12 years in prison. And after several years, the FBI had some questions. They wanted to ask him some questions regarding other forgery cases. And they would go to him, and they found him to be so helpful. He was so knowledgeable. and had so much insight, after helping getting help on a number of cases, they finally hired him, and they cut a deal saying that if he would work for the FBI for the remainder of his term, that they would be free. And so they hired him, and the man turned around. Today, he's a consultant for many Fortune 500 companies, and he actually, if you go on a website that advertises him, he will give speeches, and he gets $25,000 a speech to go to various banks and organizations and help them with their security problems. So it's an interesting story. Leonardo DiCaprio plays him in the movie, and he actually said he went and lived with him for a while, and he studied this man, and he said that the thing that was interesting about Frank here was that he had a personality that was so engaging and so disarming. He said, you just automatically trusted this guy. And he said that's something he tried to pick up and portray in the movie. But the thing is, it's to me, is he was a magnificent worker of guile. You have to hand it to him. The deceit, the cunning, the craftiness, all of it was there. And in the movie, it almost appears admirable. He deceived hundreds of people by appearing to be something else. Hundreds of people, and millions of people, actually, in our world today, are doing the very same thing. Because we're living in a world today where appearances seemingly are what matter the most. And people use their appearances to deceive and to mislead people. And, you know, the way a person appears to others actually has so much more impact today than it ever did. And I think when you look at the TV shows and you look at the news programs, we have these attractive anchors and they present the news in a certain way. And it's to me, it's an amazing thing. You can actually mislead people. And I think they do this in many cases. But my point today is about appearances and about acting. And Leonardo DiCaprio, he made an interesting comment. He says, it was so interesting to act being an actor, because that's what this man was. He was an actor. And I say this in my own thinking as I kind of watched this movie and I thought about this subject a little bit. I was very impressed with it. My mind went off a number of places, but at least in my mind in the last two decades, we haven't had really very powerful leaders except for two individuals that really stand out to me. And the world we live in, I think, is why these people were such leaders. And one of them is this. It was the individual, President Ronald Reagan, that we didn't have a man who was a statesman, really, in the presidency before him. And then when he came along, he dramatically, we were in a lull, really, we were depressed and everything, and he came along and he gave us confidence, and he changed America. He put fear into the Ayatollah Khomeini. It was an amazing thing, and I believe that just by rhetoric, in many cases, he brought down the Soviet Union. It was an amazing change that took place. And I saw it this way. He was an actor. And he knew what a statesman was supposed to look like. And he was that statesman. He became what it had to be. One more time for the Gipper, you know? And he just pulled from all these sources. The other great powerful leader that we had in recent history, to me, was Pope John Paul. And I watched that man as he went over to Europe and he went to Poland, and I watched him control the masses and how he would just interject the word solidarity. The people would cheer and move, and I watched him with just the way he would move his head. Each gesture, you could see it was controlled and it was done for a reason. And he was actually showing the Soviet authorities over there how much power he had. Thousands and thousands of people would have just done anything if he would have said the word, anything, they'd do anything for Mary, you see. But the point was, Pope John Paul studied acting, and he knew how to be Christ's representative on the earth, and how this kind of a man would act, and how he would hold himself, and how he would look caringly at the little children, and how he would give speeches. And it was orchestrated, and he used his power, and I think that was a powerful influence on the Soviet leaders there too. And I think in part, a small part maybe, but it helped lead to this fall, as it were, of the Soviet Empire. And I thought, as I looked at these individuals, I somehow thought about what would the future be like, you see? A beast and false prophet, a powerful, powerful, powerful political leader is going to come on the scene. And it's going to be appearances. It's going to be false miracles. It's going to be deceit. And a religious leader as well will combine with this individual. And at the end of the age, we're going to have probably the two greatest, most powerful leaders the world's ever seen. And it's going to all be guile. Every bit of it is going to be deceit and falsehood. And so I see this as a trait that is more apparent in U.S. leaders today than perhaps ever before. I want to make a comment about one important leader was Richard Nixon, and he had been in politics for a number of years, over 35 years, and at that time he had this unique opportunity of being able to meet with and study world leaders. And he was fascinated by leadership, and so after he was out of public service, he wrote a book called Leaders. In it, he writes this in the preface, in evaluation of a leader, the key question about his behavioral traits, he says, is not whether they're attractive or unattractive, but whether they're useful. Guile, vanity, and dissembling, in other circumstances, this might be unattractive habits, but to the leader, they can be essential. He needs guile and able to hold together the shifting coalitions of often bitterly opposed interest groups. He sometimes has to dissemble in order to prevail on crucial issues. It's also, he says, become fashionable to try to conceal ego. Another form of guile, of course, to present instead an outward modesty, but I've never known a major leader who was not an egotist. I suppose in a deceived world that authorities believe that they have to use dissembling, they have to use these things to be leaders, because their interest is to maintain power. Their interest is to exert their will over others in so many cases, to attain their goal no matter what. But you understand my point today. God is building leaders in the world to come. He is forming a cadre of assistants and people who will lead, who will serve as leaders over cities, leaders over nations. And these people, God is saying, are what? Going to be a people that don't have this trait. They're going to be a people, as he says, and we just read, a people without guile. What a fascinating and wonderful hope this is. Imagine leaders without guile. And so I want to say this, that not all guile, of course, not guile is deceitful, but it's a kind of deceit. And so all guile is deceitful, but I want to mention this, that in the Bible, whenever it uses deceit, and whenever it uses this term guile in particular, it actually is restricted and qualified. That is this, there's times, for instance, when Rahab, she actually tricked the people, remember, to preserve the spies. It's another case where God came and he said to, wasn't it Samuel, he said that, when he asked, what shall I tell him I'm doing? And he says, well, tell him you're going to give a sacrifice. Well, he was giving a sacrifice. That is, there's times when you don't have to tell everybody the whole horrible truth. Even in the Bible, it says this, that God says love covers some of these things. So it isn't a matter of you're not telling the whole truth sometimes. But when the Bible talks about guile, it's talking about using deceit in a way that is restricted, that has to have two particular traits to it. One is the motive of the individual using the guile has to be self-interest, profit for the self. It has to be for them what they can get out of it. And the second thing is it has to be deliberate, and it has to be subtle, and it has to be cunning. Now, this was, to me, the example. We'll go over here to Genesis 27. This was the example of the serpent. The serpent, when he beguiled Eve. And so it was that he was subtle and he was deceptive in what he was doing. He was deliberate. And it was very destructive. So in Genesis 27, I say this, there's another example here. And to me, it's the example of Jacob. Here is Jacob before he was ever converted. and here's how he is behaving. And this is, I think, important to understand. Let's look at this. Remember, he was going to steal the birthright from his brother, and what he does is he wraps his arms in some wool, and he gets to himself so he smells like his brother, and then he goes into his father here in Genesis 27 and verse 18. And he says, and he came unto his father, and he said, my father, and he said, here I am, who are you, my son? And Jacob said unto his father, I am Esau, your firstborn. I've done according to as you bade me. Arise, I pray you, sit and eat of my venison, that my soul may bless me. And Isaac said unto his son, how is it that you found it so quickly, my son? And he said, because the Lord your God brought it to me. And Isaac said unto Jacob, come near, I pray you, that I may feel you, my son, whether you be my son Esau or not. And Jacob went near unto Isaac his father, and he felt him, and he said, the voice of Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And he discerned him not, because his hands were hairy, and his brother's Esau's hands, as his brother's Esau hands. And so he blessed him. And he said, are you my son Esau? And he said, I am. And he said, bring it near to me, and I will eat of my son's venison, so that my soul may bless you also. And he brought it near to him, and he did eat, and he brought him wine, and he drank. And his father Isaac said unto him, come near now, kiss me, my son. And he came near and kissed him, and smelled the smell of his raiment, and blessed him, and said, see, the smell of my son is the smell of the field which the Lord had blessed. And so then he gives him this blessing. But it's explained in verse 35 what took place later. He realizes this, and he says, your brother came with subtlety and is taken away, your blessing. You see, this is an element that has to be, it has to be deliberate, it has to be crafty, deceit, to become what the Bible calls guile, or as the serpent beguiled Eve. And haven't you ever experienced this kind of thing? How many of you have had a salesman that promised you something, and then later they tell you, oh, that feature only comes with the upgrade, or it's going to cost more money to get this. But you get the appearance you're going to get this, and then you get something far less. Or you promise it's going to cost only this much, and then later it's this much, and there's this fee and that fee and added fees, and just pumps this thing up. And that's what's going on, I think, in our whole society today. People posing as something they're not to get what they want from you. And so here we have an economy today, and I know I've talked about this before, but to me it applies so much in this case. We're talking about guile today, and in the case of guile, I think the advertising industry are the ones that have raised this thing to a science, because they now will give you these emotions on television. They don't tell you how great the product is. They don't tell you the value of it. They don't tell you, well, they'll do this for you, this and this and this. But what they do is they take the product and they sort of make the product take place, or they show this product being used in an environment where people are happy, where they're secure, where they're competent. And they associate the product with all these feelings, and then subconsciously you see the person watching the commercials, they think, if I purchase this product, if I have this car, I'll be more masculine. I'll be thought of as more youthful. I'll be thought of as more fun to be with. If I have this deodorant, I know I'll feel secure. So they buy the product, you see, in order to feel those feelings. But you're not going to feel those feelings, because it's all a trick. It's all deceit. And I think it is this thing that we're talking about today, and it's guile. So, in contrast, the resurrected saints are without guile. Now, the word guile is dolos in the Greek, and it means to decoy or trick. And it definitely includes, of course, deceit and subtlety. It means to entice or to bait somebody else, to certainly not to be what we need to be, and it's this: transparent. We need to be who and what we are. We need to be honest. We need to be sincere in all cases, in everything that we say and everything that we do. And let's go over to James 3 for a moment and look at this. By way of reminder, 144,000 are without guile. And so you see the, you see an impression, I believe, James, Peter, and John, James 3. You see a people that aren't going to try to mislead others to try to look better in their eyes. They're not going to try to make someone else look less than. They're not going to play anything a certain way for specific purposes. They're going to be who and what they are. They're going to be honest and sincere, and they're not going to speak things that are deceitful or mislead others for any kind of gain. And so in James, it says here, speaking about the tongue, he says that this tongue, this tool that God has given our body, is so powerful and so on, but it can be some of the biggest problems for us. In verse 2, in many things, it says we offend all. If any man offends not in word, the same is a perfect man and able also to bridle the whole body. Behold, we put bits in the horses' mouths so that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. Behold also the ships which, though they be so great and are driven of fierce winds, yet they're turned with a very small helm, wherever the governor lists, or wherever they want to go. I remember being on an icebreaker, and it was an interesting ship. It had sort of a round hull like the bottom half of a football that would just roll all over the sea. But still, it's pretty impressive when you think about it, because I was on the helm. I would many times take us into port. Or I'd be in the rough seas, and we'd hit 20-foot waves once, and the ship would go down like this, and it would, you couldn't see anything. You could not see sky because you're going down. Then you'd go up, and that's all you could see was sky. And then you'd come off crashing off the top. But you understand, I was driving. I had the helm, a wheel this big, and a compass. And with that wheel, I could turn that ship and go any way that ship that I wanted it to go. It's an amazing thing to think about it, but it says this, even so the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. Behold, how great a matter a little fire kindles. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity, and so is the tongue among our members, that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature and is set on the fires of hell. And so it says in verse 8, the tongue can no man tame, it's an unruly evil full of deadly poison. And thereby we bless God the Father, and we curse men, and who are made in the similitude of God. And so here it is, the tongue can be used for all these different purposes. In our world today, I see it as being used very much in the form of guile, used to trick other people so that you can take advantage of them. You can offer them something that they're not going to get. Let's go over to Psalm 101. You can see this, where the ones that God will use in the kingdom of God are going to be people that are not like this. They're going to control their tongues. They're going to refrain from saying things that mislead. They're going to they're going to not adjust what they say to make themselves look better or make someone else look bad. And they're not going to even focus on the sensational, adjust their comments to get advantage. But what they are is what they are. Psalm 101 verse 7 says this, he that works deceit shall not dwell within my house, and he that tells lies shall not tarry in my sight. And so it is. Who's going to dwell in God's house? Those people that don't have guile, is what he's saying. Matthew 15, let's go over there for a minute. Those people that are going to be God's people are not going to be tellers of lies. They're not going to be misrepresenting things for their own purposes and their own gain. No exaggerations to get people's sympathy. No twistings of things to kind of make your case look better. And not trying to make others look inferior to you. No deliberate lies to get ahead. But here's the thing. I think we have to realize that this issue of guile doesn't start with the tongue. It starts somewhere else, doesn't it? It isn't, yes, it starts not in what we say. It starts in what we think. What we think is what's going to give us what we're going to say. And that's what we've got to focus on. So in Matthew 15, verse 19, it says this, "For out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, and false witnesses, and blasphemies." And so the act is actually going to start inside where we think, and that's where the battle has to begin. And when I look at all the Bible heroes, I mean, I've really seen this, and I guess I've been convicted about it because of the world we live in. But I look back and I see people like Moses, and I see how they're just transparent, that they were not looking to men and what men thought about them. They were looking to God, weren't they, for their protection. They were looking for God to give them favor in other people's eyes. They weren't looking to other people, and so they weren't trying to play the political games. They weren't trying to make things appear a certain way. And you look at Moses, powerful man. Yes, he made some mistakes, didn't he? And sometimes he got angry. But what was his motive? Was he trying to get for himself from anybody? No. Don't you see a man there that was just simply and humbly God's servant? And I look at Daniel and all that he went through. And when we went and did that Bible study on Daniel, this is what I saw. A man who was transparent. He didn't have an edge, did he? He was there. He served Nebuchadnezzar. He served God. If there was a conflict, he served God. And whatever took place, took place. And he didn't try to ingratiate himself to all of these religious magicians and all the rest of them. He didn't have to do that. He just simply trusted in God. And here we are now, we're going through the book of John. What do you see when you see John? You're reading the gospel that he wrote, and yet he's like almost invisible. Notice how he speaks of himself in the third person in the book. He's not about him. It's about God. It's about truth. It's about things where he doesn't have to play a role. And we see this when we see Paul too. Here he is, a great servant of God, going from church to church, and whatever happens to him, he's not concerned about himself. He would defend himself. But you understand it was for the purpose of the gospel and the respect towards his office, and it wasn't about him. And so you see this over and over. And I say this today for this reason. You and I have been in the last month or so moving closer and closer, trying to understand how do we deepen our conversion? How do we overcome sin? We've been talking about this, and we've come to see that it's got to be being closer to God, that it's got to be that we develop more of a relationship with him, and this is what changes our thinking and so on. But I want to say, too, that if we just look at only side, and we don't see that there are things that have to be resisted. Remember how James said, resist the devil. So there's things that have to be resisted. Well, I want to say today, one of the things that needs to be resisted in our life is this issue of guile. But I believe it's in us. I think it's a part of human nature to try to do this. Jeremiah 17:9, the famous scripture, Romans 9. But I want to just read it today in this context for us to reiterate this, I think, vital truth. Our human nature has guile in it. It will lie to us, and it will help us justify and rationalize almost any action we want to take. And if we don't do something about it, if we don't resist it, it can lead us to become individuals who will use deceit and who will try to play things in order to get our way. And it says it for this reason in Jeremiah 17:9. It says this, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I, the Lord, search the hearts. I try the reins, even to give every man according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings." And so I say this, there is Christian warfare, and we've got to get close to God. We've got to study, and we've got to pray, and we've got to work on the Christian disciplines. But we also need to be aware of what the enemy is. And the enemy is often right inside us. In the form of human nature. I remember this cartoon I saw one time. It was fine. Have you ever seen the Pogo cartoons? I think they're kind of cute sometimes, and this one was really a historic classic. It has Pogo here, and he's on this bow of a boat, and the boat is on the river, and they're crossing the river, and he has his sword up high. He has one foot in the boat, he has the other one on the bow, and he's saying, "We have met the enemy, and it's us." It's kind of cute, but you understand the point. I think he makes this, it's got some validity to it. That is, the enemy can be subtle and crafty down inside the core of the human psyche, inside every one of us in our human nature. We can be deceitful, and we don't see it. And so in overcoming sin, there's a number of things to do, and I suggest that we use this sermon today to realize that there is a battle that must go on. We are Christian soldiers. We're in warfare, and that one of the enemies that we have to face is ourselves. And this issue of guile is a pretty big issue if you begin to look at it. Now, over 2,000 years ago, there was a man who existed, a very unique man, if you go to John 1. And the man's name was Nathanael. And Jesus Christ had called him to eventually be one of his apostles, that he first was going to be a disciple and he would follow Jesus Christ and eventually be one of his apostles. And the account of him meeting Jesus Christ, I think, has got a very interesting lesson for you and me. John 1 and verse 47. Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him, and he said unto him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no guile." Now, when he said an Israelite indeed, he really was talking about that, not that he was an Israelite by birth. He wasn't talking about his genealogy. But he was talking about being an Israelite that was worthy of the name Israel, that is, Prince of God. Overcomer, that's what Israel actually means. And here was a man who was in the process of overcoming, you see. And he was a man who, he said, didn't have this trait. He didn't have guile about him. So he exhibited genuine integrity there. He was a man who lived his life looking forward to the expectation of the coming Messiah and the kingdom of God. And he then lived his life in preparation so that he would be a part of that kingdom when it finally came, living by the standards that God had set for Israel. And when he spoke of the Israel, I really believe he was speaking of not just physical Israel, but he was speaking about the Israel of God that Paul speaks about, where he says, "They're not all Israel who are of Israel." And he speaks of a spiritual Israel, of which physical Israel was only a type, and he said that it would be the church. And then in that context, he says that all those things were written about Israel for those who lived at the end of the age, and that there would be a spiritual Israel. They would be the leaders of God's kingdom in the kingdom of God. And here was this man who exhibited the traits and was in preparation for that kingdom. Now, Nathanael grew up around the area of Galilee, where, of course, there was a huge fishing industry. And Barclay writes in his commentary that because this area is a fishing industry, they use this word dolos or guile all the time. You know what it meant to them? Fish bait. See, that was something that we used, or they used, to put on a hook or in to scatter out on the sea to around their nets to attract the fish. And it was a decoy, you see. It was a trick to get them to fall into their net so they could catch them. And so they use this term all the time, and he would have understood it this way. And that's what so many people are today, it seems to me. They're like baiting people, trying to catch them in a net, whether it's on television or magazine ads and so on. So the beautiful thing about Nathanael was that he didn't have this trait. He wasn't deceitful, he wouldn't use fraud, and he wasn't hypocritical. It wasn't that he didn't have sin, because all of us have sin. But he wasn't trying to pretend he didn't have sin. He wasn't going around with the flowing robes and the phylacteries and all that, pretending to be somebody he wasn't. He just was what he was. Now, after this, Jesus answers him in verse 48, or he says to Nathanael says unto him, "Whence knowest thou me?" And Jesus answered and said unto him, "Before that Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Now the fig tree in Israel had a couple of meanings. And of course, remember from Micah that the fig tree was a symbol of the millennial period and would be able to sit under his vine and fig tree, and there would be prosperity, and there would be time for people to meditate. And so in Israel at the time, it was, when you spoke of a fig tree or sitting under your fig tree, you were really picturing a time when people would meditate. And so it's very likely that when Christ saw him under the fig tree, you see, he was under the fig tree perhaps meditating or praying at the time. And Christ, remember, was God on earth, and he knew a woman at the well about her husbands. He knew that she hadn't been married. She knew her life. He knew her lifestyle without ever asking a word. He could actually read minds when he was on the earth. And I believe he was able to look into Nathanael's mind, and his conclusion was, wow, a man without guile. Wow, I can use him. And he called Nathanael to be one of those leaders who will one day be one of the 144,000. In a like manner today, Jesus Christ sees our thoughts, and he can read into us and see what we're thinking. Verse 49, Nathanael answers and says unto him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God, the King of Israel." And so here's Nathanael going, "You knew what I was doing under that tree, didn't you? You knew what I was thinking about. You've got to be the Son of God. You've got to be the King of Israel." And he believed on him. Well, I want us to realize today Jesus Christ can read our minds, and he can see what motivates us, and he can see what it is that drives you and me in whatever we do in our lives. Now, today we're standing on the brink of probably a major change in history because of what's going on in Iraq. It's very interesting about this. The entire world is now focused on Saddam Hussein and the resolutions and the mandate that have come from the UN now and those other committee of nations there. And the U.S. now is poised to now enforce these resolutions no matter what takes place. Will the nation of Iraq be forthcoming? Are they going to show their weapons of mass destruction? Few people have any hope that he will. It said this, that Saddam Hussein is as good as his word, but his word's no good. And he is this kind of man. He is a Hitler type, a tyrant, a rogue state. But the thing that's interesting is this, is everything that he has built his whole life is at stake now. He could lose everything, including his entire life. Instead, will he then play it right? Will he cut a deal and save those people and save himself? Or is he going to let it all be destroyed? What are his real intentions? Will he hide the arms, relocating them here and just staying ahead of the inspectors and relocating them there? What is he going to do? But you have to realize this. In his case, here's the resolution that we are to have, and these inspectors are to have, absolute and total unfettered access to everything in Iraq. They can walk into his palace, into his bedroom, into his bathroom. They have full, complete, unfettered access. Okay, the question becomes this. What if people had full, unfettered access to you, like Jesus Christ? What if they could look inside and see what's really motivating you? What would they see? Are we a people without guile? are we a people that aren't false and we're not hypocrites? Or is our word to be trusted? What are we really like, you see? It's an interesting analogy and comparison here, because Jesus Christ can look at every one of us, just like he did Nathaniel, inside and see what we're like and see if we're mismotivated. And he sees those good thoughts we have, and he sees the good things we do, but he also sees the less noble things that we do too. My point today is this, is we need to realize that we're supposed to follow him. Let's go to 1 Peter, if you will, 1 Peter, and follow the example that he left for us, 1 Peter 2 and verse 22. Here's what Jesus was like, 1 Peter 2 and verse 22. And starting in verse 21, for even hereunto were you called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in his steps. Really? Well, what should you be like? It talks about him, Jesus, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. And so we're to follow him, and we're to have no guile. And this is a tough call because of our human nature and because of what we're like. We want to protect ourselves. We want to look the best we can. But yet every year we go through an exercise, don't we, in the days of unleavened bread. And we eat this flat piece of bread. It's not very attractive, but we understand what it's really picturing. Not being puffed up. It's picturing us putting Christ in us and living a way of life like he lives. It is living a life that is just flat. We're not great. We're not better than we really are. We're not puffed up. We're not trying to look like we're bigger or better or anything better than what we really are. The people who are transparent. The people who are honest and sincere. And so I say this, if we strive to get closer and closer to God, let's do this. Let's realize that this is an important trait. Let's realize that Jeremiah 17:9 isn't kidding us, that we have a heart that is deceitful inside us. It's part of human nature. And we need to be on guard about this thing. And realize we live in a world that is a world that does have guile as a part of its way of life. I was watching the other day, I was making something to eat, and the kids were watching a sitcom, and it was really funny. I happened to look up, and I saw this one little piece of it, and it was kind of cute. This man had come home to his wife, and he says to her, "I'm so excited. I'm so excited. The boss called me in his office, and the boss tells me that he says there's an opening coming, and he thinks that I might be qualified for the position. And he says, so I invited him to dinner, and we're going to come over, and we're going to play bridge." And she says, "But sweetheart, you don't know how to play bridge." He says, "That's okay. I know I don't know how, but you know how, and you can teach me." And she says, "Oh, no, I don't really know how." He says, "You told me when we were dating that you could play bridge." And she said, "But that was date talk. That was date talk. When we were dating, I just wanted to impress you. I wanted you to think I was cultured." And he goes, "Oh, no," you know, and he gets real angry at her. And she says, "But you told me when we were dating that you tried out for the next." And he says, "Well, it's date lies. It doesn't count." And the point is that, you know, I have counseled so many people in marriage. And I remember time after time where this was always an issue that came up. And I remember this one guy saying to his wife, "You never go to the beach. I love to go to the beach." And before we were married, you went to the beach all the time. And she says, "Yeah, but that was before we were married. I hate going to the beach." But yet we play it, don't we? We do that. We aren't always what we really are. And these are just an example in one case. And it's so tragic. We pretend to be something we're not, and then later it catches us and it comes back and bites us. And so on. Let's conclude over here in Psalm 15. Psalm 15. Right now, I say this for a reason. Who didn't try to look better than they were when they were dating? I don't know. A lot of us did that. Do you know who we're dating now? Jesus Christ, aren't we? There's an espousal period, and we are said, as Paul writes, we are espoused to Jesus Christ. And so are we just trying to give lip service? Are we just saying, oh, yes, I'm a Christian? Oh, yes, I want to do this? Oh, really, I'm going to be like this? And is it just lip service, you see? Are we just, is it just date talk as we prepare to marry Jesus Christ? Or is it real? Are we really sincere? Well, again, he comes back and he says this in Psalm 15, Lord, who shall abide in your tabernacle? Who shall dwell in your holy hill? He that walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. He that backbites not with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his neighbor, in whose eyes a vile person is condemned. But he that honors them that fear the Lord, he that swears to his own hurt and doesn't change, he that puts not out his money to usury, but takes reward against the innocent. He that does these things shall never be moved. This to me describes the 144,000, a people who are being trained, who are striving to live without guile. And so I ask us today, will we consider this aspect in our Christian growth and realize there is something in us to guard against, something to watch out for, an enemy, as it were, that lives inside of us that can come out if we aren't getting close to God and developing the Christian nature and the mind of Jesus Christ. To me, Saddam Hussein today is the epitome of human nature and unleashed. And a man who would lie, hurt, and destroy even his own people. And we're going to be, I think, like these people in Revelation, who are a people without guile. Now, in the case of Frank Abagnale, he says today, he's so grateful to live in America. You know why? He says he believes it's the only country that'll give you a second chance. He's a changed man now, and he helps the other side. You understand, aren't you grateful to be in the Church of God? Because it is a church that God gives us another chance. But we've all made mistakes in the past, but the whole future is before us, and we can change, and with his help, we will change and be a people without guile.